This is Henry and Seb, a podcast series of stories from my new book, Sir Henry Wood, Champion of J.S. Bach. It's about the bits that intrigue me most as I piece together a jigsaw that had previously eluded historians and musicians. The founding conductor of the Proms, Henry Wood, turns out to be the missing link in the tale of how the music of Johann Sebastian Bach became popular in the UK. Today, I'd like to tell you a tale about Wood and the St. Matthew Passion, and it starts with Wood recounting a memory.
I shall always remember my dear father packing me off very early one morning when I was quite a lad to a Birmingham music festival to hear Bach's Matthew Passion. Shall I ever forget it? 4 hours of dull, dreary, monotonous slogging. Nothing but first violins and double basses. Oh, how boring! That churchy, dull, dead, ploughed-through performance of this immortal work awoke in me the determination to make Bach live. The sensitive musician he undoubtedly was, and not what these purists would have him, merely because it was not customary in those far-off days to mark a score, but leave it to the performer to interpret.
Now, the thing with Wood's memories, which he published, aged 69, in his jubilee year of conducting 1938, is that they are notoriously sketchy. My Life of Music, as they're titled, might better have been called A Life of Music, or The Musical Life as I wanted to remember it. But even if details don't quite add up, it's still telling as to what he really thought about things. And what is certain is that his performances of the St. Matthew Passion were the antithesis of what he described there. There are no recordings. So in order to recreate a sonic picture of what he did, we've got to look at scores and reviews. And in his memoirs, the only chapter dedicated to a single composer and work was Bach and the St. Matthew Passion. So that in itself gives a sense of how important it was to him. And after his death, the broadcaster Alex Robertson wrote that in times of real tiredness and stress, Wood would go to his score of the Matthew Passion. It was the score he treasured most of all in the world. It was his deepest faith become music. And in that music, he'd always find repose. That full score is in fact missing from the Wood archive. I'd love to find out where that ended up. But never fear, there are lots of other clues. It's an interesting thing that Wood never put on the Passions or the B minor Mass at the Proms. That just wasn't the place within the orchestral remit of the concerts at the time. But it wasn't even heard there until Carl Richter performed it in 1968. No, the place for the St. Matthew Passion in Wood's day was at city music festivals. And these were big business, attracting huge audiences and major composers who would go there to premiere their latest works. Wood's story with the St. Matthew Passion starts in Sheffield. Steelopolis, they called it, long established as one of Britain's major centres of steel cutlery production. Sheffield enjoyed a vibrant music scene, attracting the finest instrumentalists and vocalists from surrounding areas. The triennial Sheffield Musical Festival was inaugurated in 1896, just 3 years after Sheffield gained city charter status, so it was a relatively late addition to the calendar of major civic festivals. But it was hugely distinguished. From the get-go, they appointed August Manns, the conductor of London's Crystal Palace concerts, and chorus master Henry Coward, who was local. He was a former cutlery apprentice who'd become a critically renowned virtuoso choral trainer. It began as a 2-day festival, initially held in October, and expanded quickly to 3 days in 1899. Morning and evening concerts took place in Sheffield's Albert Hall. Now, I said these things were weighty. In just 2 days, the 1896 festival had put on 10 substantial works, including Mendelssohn's Elijah, Sullivan's Golden Legend, Berlioz's Damnation of Faust, Parry's Job, and Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony. And it was common for composers to conduct their own premieres, so audiences were treated to Elgar, Parry, and Coleridge Taylor on the rostrum. Manns retired in 1902, and Henry Wood joined Henry Coward to take the festival into the new century. The premieres kept on coming. For example, Elgar's Coronation Mass, which had been intended for the coronation of Edward VII, but delayed owing to the monarch's illness, so premiered here instead. And Wood also began to programme Bach, rather than the ever-popular Handel, beginning with the motet Jesu Meine Freude. That year, the Steelopolis was acclaimed as the forefront of musical festivals, the Sheffield Chorus as unrivalled, That is after 61 rehearsals, you'd hope they would be. Dr. Henry Coward was the master chorus master, and Sir Henry Wood, a successful festival conductor. Job done. Well, the stage was set for the work that Wood had been turning over and over in his mind, the St. Matthew Passion. And the 1908 festival was the year he made it happen. Now, at this point, the work wasn't new to audiences. There was already a long tradition of performing it in the UK, stretching back to the first English performances by William Stendhal Bennett, who had himself heard the work performed by Mendelssohn. The performance in 1908 wouldn't be a premiere. Audiences believed they knew what they were going to be hearing. But orally, it was a revelation, and the ideas would infuse all of Wood's future performances. After all, he'd resolved to make the work live, and it was still being discussed in the popular press in the 1930s. So what did he actually do? Well, more than 50 years before the experiments of the period performance specialists, such as Nicolaus Harnoncourt, Wood pre-echoed some of their interests, and his first concern was the available editions. Specifically, he didn't care for the popular English translation made by Helen Johnson in the 1862 William Stendhal Bennett edition. He felt it didn't accurately reflect the gospel message, but he also didn't approve of the orchestration made by Robert Franz that most people used for large-scale productions. He took issue with the way Franz added trumpets, trombones and drums in order to balance the large choirs used in modern performances. You know, I found Wood's own copy of Franz's edition, and all the way through, he's like a headmaster marking wrong where he found faults or mistakes. So the solution? Well, Wood decided to revisit and revise the score published by the Bachgesellschaft, preparing a new edition specifically for festival use. Wood's experiences of working with the Dolmetsch family in that 1901 lecture in Nottingham shows that he knew about Bach's performing conditions with a small choir and orchestra. But in Sheffield in 1908, he balanced his orchestra against 94 sopranos, 79 contraltos, 83 tenors and 80 basses.
And a Yorkshire choir at that.
Nothing wrong with Yorkshire choirs. Wood was offered work with a large festival, and it was just a totally different affair. He stated his intention to
amplify Bach's own instrumentation, but by keeping it strictly to his score.
So he did this by adding to a very full complement of strings 8 flutes, 8 oboes, and 8 bassoons, concluding,
I imagine, had he lived to produce it at a 20th century festival performance of the work, Bach would have done the same.
But he did look to retain the sound of some of Bach's specific instruments and commissioned a 7-string viola da gamba and 2 each of oboes d'amore and da caccia, which he lent to players for his performances. Wood comes across as a pragmatist, respectfully adapting the score for his conditions without the effects he'd use later in his own enormous orchestral concert arrangements. Then he approached the London manager of Breitkopf & Härtel, Otto Kling, to discuss the project. He claimed that following numerous meetings, Breitkopf & Härtel agreed to republish the work with a new, more accurate translation made by Claude Aveling. So Wood bought 400 copies, and he marked each of them up according to voice type with meticulous performing directions, and he kept them in his library for whenever he performed the Passion. They survive in the Wood archive, and they're almost an overwhelming impression of Wood's industry. His scrupulous attention to detail is particularly lavished on the choruses. He took his artistic license directly from Bach, claiming
probably he told his choir what he wanted.
And so each phrase is shaped, each breath is marked, each accent is stressed. And the markings paid off. Reviewers in 1908 were unanimous when they wrote that
the chorus singing was sublime. There is no other word to describe it.
Text was at the heart of his often quite extreme textures, but not all the effects came off. Across the years, there was continual disapproval of his treatment of the chorus Have Lightnings and Thunders, which evidently he performed with really sharp staccato. This sacrifice of tone was recognised as an excellent way of projecting the words, but was a text-driven sacrifice too far for many people. a really striking element was that he went in for extreme dynamics, and some were really quite surprising. He decided on a pianissimo ending, going against the published markings, and reviewers complained that
the lovely last chorus was somewhat too faintly treated.
It was definitely not what you would expect from a performance otherwise characterised by an
overwhelming grandeur
that would
live long in the memory when all else has been forgotten.
But Wood was making it live, making people think and react. And even by 1930, William Brehre remembered,
"The dramatic commotion of the multitude as represented by the Sheffield chorus was so realistic as to be impossible in a church. These scenes were alive with real passions, enabling one to live in the tragic past depicted."
This was Wood's lifelong approach, epitomised really in 1927, when the dramatisation of the Royal Academy of Music choir's choruses was described as superb, and that
Barabbas is always electrifying, but yesterday it was very much more. Followed by Let Him Be Crucified, it aroused for a moment a twinge of panic. The choir had become a well-led mob.
Wood's dramatic treatment of Bach attracted attention from outside the music world too. Nearly 100 years before Glyndebourne first staged the Matthew Passion, Wood claimed to have been in discussion with the English modernist theatre practitioner Gordon Craig on staging the work as a passion play. They got as far as sketching out scenes, but the venture proved too expensive to put on. Well, that's the choruses. What of the other elements? Wood's chorales probably caused the most controversy. He was clear that they should
represent the sentiments of a crowd of simple worshippers,
as the original melodies
were the sentiments of the peasantry and virtually folk tunes,
but seemed fairly flexible with them. In the marked-up scores, every phrase is addressed with dynamics and breath marks, and accents pervade, as do instructions for different accompaniments, standing or sitting, and whether the first or second choirs should in fact alternate phrases. But Wood's creativity extended to using soloists to sing the chorales, the antithesis of his own rationale for representing the sentiments of the peasants and the villagers. This doesn't appear to have been popular. Reminiscing on the 1908 performance, Brehre noted that twice the chorales were sung first by the solo quartet, and while that led to a further general reflection, it also revealed an
exaggerated emphasis and over-crispness.
This, combined with the soloist's vibrato, resulted in
pedantry so pumped as to sound inflexible, even stilted, therefore defeating utterly the end in view.
Why did he do this? Well, he said,
"I have directed the chorales as Bach intended for his church performances, with the congregation joining the choristers, but have found this congregational singing in a large concert hall not only detracted from the spirit of reverence, but that a great deal of his masterly harmonisation was lost."
And that's true. He did have a go in the late 1920s at the Royal Academy of Music. But then
the audience was composed of 800 professors and students, each with a marked copy.
And even still, he didn't think it worked. You see, Wood was the ever practical musician. He had to keep an eye on the box office and work out what really worked where. Now, there were few who promoted the harpsichord in this period. And while recognising it as the traditional instrument, Wood despaired of how
horrible this is today in a large concert hall, and for that matter, horrible under any conditions.
It was not just the lack of projection and
the jingle-jangle of a tinny sound,
but the
jarring effect
that led him to conclude,
"In fact, we might just as well use mandolins and banjos."
The piano was a popular replacement, but actually Wood favoured the organ, or in some instances, four cellos and a bass. He muted the strings for Jesus's recitatives, creating what he dubbed a
tonal hush,
more appropriate for the
sayings of Christ in a passion work.
It was an arrangement that made sense for a performance in a church, but somehow it went against the dramatic presentation that Wood otherwise looked for in these festival performances, and the decision not to use a piano baffled many critics. You can sort of see why history has forgotten Wood's performances of the St. Matthew Passion. But from what I can hear, I can't help but love them for what they were and what they did. They energised audiences and they opened up Bach as a composer of real human emotion. Now, if you want to delve into more detail from this performance and later ones, and also the B minor Mass, you might just have to buy the book, or at least ask your local library to get a copy. I just want to leave you with the performance of one of the arias at Sheffield in 1908, because it's a musical picture that I just can't get out of my head. The soloists for these performances were top draw and included Wood's first wife, the phenomenal soprano Olga. And a review of her performance reveals the power behind the throne when it came to shaping interpretations of Bach. Mrs. Wood's voice, they wrote, had just the rich, subdued emotional colour which she skilfully varied by her delicate treatment of ornaments and unaccented notes, and by her symmetrical phrasing. The difficulties of Bach's phraseology vanished, and the airs acquired a beautiful simplicity by the art which conceals art. Quite the review. Wood's former pupil had become not only his wife, but his inspiration, and she and Wood were a true musical power couple, cruelly separated the following year by her death. And yet, in the duet, Betrayed is Jesus Now, she sang with the festival's principal contralto, Jessie Goldsack. Now Jessie, over 25 years later, would become Wood's last partner. Not his wife, the interim wife Muriel would make sure that never happened. But here, in Bach and Sheffield and the St. Matthew Passion, were perhaps the greatest and most enduring loves of Wood's life.